Hello and welcome to The Blockchain and Us, where pioneers and thought leaders talk about their journey in blockchain technology, crypto assets, and the token economy. And I'm your host, Manuel Staggers. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. My guest today is Tone Vase. Tone is an independent content creator focusing on economics and finance at Liberty Life Trail with his own YouTube channel and podcast. Before that, he has worked on Wall Street for almost 10 years, starting as a risk analyst at Bear Stearns, where he had a front row seat watching its collapse in a 2008 crash, and he later became a vice president at JP Morgan Chase. Tone is famous for his technical analysis of Bitcoin and his price predictions, and he was featured in the Bitcoin documentary Magic Money. And now, to the interview. Hi, Tone, and thanks a lot for making time today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me on the podcast. It's great.
On your LinkedIn profile, pretty much the first thing anybody reads there is, to know why your ICO /token sale is probably a scam, my consulting rate is 0.1 Bitcoin per hour. I'll be more than happy to explain it to you. So in your view, why are most ICOs scams?
I just want to mention that there is a bit of a lie in that statement these days. My consulting rate is 0.1 Bitcoin per hour, but I really have no interest in explaining to people why their ICOs or token sales are probably scams. Those have been very, very frustrating for me personally, and I kind of been avoiding them, even though some have asked to, you know, have me explain it to them. Okay, so my view on it is this. The world has had over 100 years of laws that have come about in a way of who you can solicit money from in order to fund your speculative project. Mm-hmm. Like, no one cares if you borrow money from your friends and family. That becomes a personal matter when you're going to start your business or you're going to, you know, speculate on something. And you want to borrow from friends and family, that's fine. If you don't have your own money, I mean, the thing you're supposed to do, you're supposed to save money and then use your own money to start whatever it is you want to do. It's kind of what Satoshi Nakamoto did to give us Bitcoin. You know, he didn't go fundraising for this. He just went ahead and did it. Other than that, you go to the people close to you for money. If you don't have those people, you can try going to the bank for money, and a bank's job is to assess the risk of your project. And the banks don't really mess with, you know, speculative startups. So you have to go to angel investors and VCs that collect money from qualified investors, and then it's their job to decide where to invest this money in a speculative way, mm-hmm. To potentially bring money to those high net worth and qualified investors. And what makes a person qualified is the fact that they have money. They have money they can lose. They have money to invest in very speculative nature. And if they don't have the time or the resources to investigate these speculative projects to invest in, they give their money to a professional that is supposed to do that job for them. So the ICOs have removed that entire structure from the equation. And now anyone who wants to, you know, make their dream a reality, and as we all know, 90%+ of all businesses fail. Forget speculative businesses and technology that may or may not even work. Even businesses that are proven to work will probably fail 90% of the time. And now you are able to solicit anyone in the world on the internet for money for your idea. And I don't see what good can possibly come from that, because all of these people investing in these ICOs, they don't understand the project. They don't care about what the company is. They say they do, but they really don't. They're just speculating on the ICO because with no regulation on trading these ICOs, they want to just, you know, make their money and sell those digital tokens to the next person, so they end up holding the bag on something they also don't understand. So this has removed all regulation on not only financing, but also securities, because now anyone can just go ahead and create a security of their company in the form of an ICO.
You said basically what we're discussing or what you just outlined is the mechanism of fundraising, right?
Correct.
Where you say there's no qualified person who actually pre-qualifies the project. Is this even worth any money, right? Which would be the traditional role of the VC.
Correct.
But I mean, I spoke to some VCs too, and they also, some of them invest in ICOs. So they say, well, you know, it's an interesting fundraising mechanism, but the project itself that the token, you know, funds may still not be a scam.
Sure. But like, again, a VC's job is to create returns for the investors in their VC fund. So if they see an opportunity to put that money into an ICO, I mean, they could. But what happens here is this stuff immediately gets sold to unqualified investors. Mm. In a traditional world, I mean, back in the 90s, a lot of companies were just going public just because they had a .com and no actual product. And look where that got us. I mean, sure, lots of good companies came out of the dot-com era, but the average person ended up losing a lot of money because mm-hmm. they were buying into these stocks because there was very little oversight over which of these dot-coms will go public on the internet. And then the opposite was happening. I mean, Facebook delayed for as long as they could before they went public trading on the stock market. A lot of these companies nowadays, they're trying to delay that. Back in the day, you used to go public as soon as possible so that everybody can cash out. And the same thing is happening now. A lot of these VCs that invest so early in these ICOs, they want these ICOs to be traded in an unregulated environment as soon as possible so they can immediately cash out onto the unqualified investor.
Mm, good point.
It's no different than a stock going IPO, but stocks today don't really go IPO unless there's a company, there's a product, there's sales, there's something there. It also costs a lot of money to go IPO because guess what? Your company needs to have some money in order to go through the regulation of going IPO. These ICOs don't do anything like that. And the oversight that you mentioned, another big function of a VC that invests in a lot of these speculative ideas is to kind of oversee what is going on there. When a VC gives money to a startup trying to create new technology, that VC will have a say in that company's operations, at least a little bit. They'll have a board seat. They can have a say in who's the is the ICO going in the right direction? Is the CEO wasting funds? None of that is true in this case. You have an idea. You went ICO. You got all this money. There's no one overseeing what you can and can't do with that money. There's absolutely no one that can tell you what to do. And there's nothing stopping you from just running away with that money the next day. And we've already seen some of that. And the average person is just not capable of knowing where they're investing their money in. They just got to cash out before the bubble bursts.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think that's what most of them hope they'll still be able to do. But as you said before, somebody will be left holding the bag. And when do you think that will happen?
No one really knows. I mean, I didn't think it would get this bad. But now it seems that everyone just wants to print their own money and create their own securities. They're doing it under the disguise of an application token. But to me, from day one, an application token never made any sense. It's like asking your Amazon shoppers to pay in Amazon stock for the product and no other currency.
Yeah.
I mean, these application tokens make absolutely no sense. A casino has an application token, right? You can't just put $100 bills on a bet. You have to buy the chips from the casino for the simplicity of functions inside the casino. But these chips do not have their own speculative value as a currency. They're pegged to whatever jurisdiction the casino lies in, whether it's euros or dollars. That's an example of an application token that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Airline miles are application tokens, but they're pegged to a certain price of a ticket or a certain mileage of a plane. They don't have speculative value that gets traded by 13-year-olds in an unregulated market. I mean, these things just make absolutely no sense. Why do you want to turn all of your users into speculators of your platform?
Mm-hmm. Well, simple answer is to raise $100 million.
Oh, correct. And these days, it's all about who you know and are you able to create the media hype in order to get that money in. It's not about the idea. It's about fundraising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You said 90%+ will fail. So 99, maybe 98?
In this case, yes. I mean, 90% of most businesses do fail. And in this case, considering almost every single one you look at has absolutely nothing behind it other than a fancy website and a freely traded ICO, that percentage has to go up to 99%, kind of like the number of dot-coms that were no longer listed on the New York Stock Exchange after 2003.
Mm-hmm. But what about that other 1%? What would that be in your view?
In my view, it would simply be the companies that found a way to utilize Bitcoin. I see Bitcoin as the one public blockchain that is going to be sustainable in the long term.
Would those companies also have had an ICO?
No. Well, they might have had an ICO, but they're probably not, the regulatory environment will probably hurt them. I don't see it that way. I see, to me, there will only be one blockchain, just like we only have one internet. Mm-hmm. And whoever utilized the internet the best was able to succeed, whether it's eBay, Amazon, Yahoo, Google. Whoever utilized the internet properly, Facebook, utilized the internet better than MySpace, and they succeeded. So to me, whoever is going to utilize the Bitcoin blockchain the best is going to succeed. Now, my guess is it's probably not going to be a company that ICO'd, because almost everyone that ICOs has no interest in the Bitcoin blockchain. They just want to build something different.
Right.
So companies that are managed to utilize Bitcoin, and you know what? There's probably not going to be all that many. Again, some of our biggest companies today are, you know, tech and internet companies, but there is not many of them. And others, you know, are building technology like for the internet, right? So like IBM is building chips, mm-hmm. and, you know, Dell is building laptops. So we have something similar like that, right? We have multiple companies that are building Bitcoin mining hardware, mm-hmm. and these companies have been very successful and they never needed an ICO. I mean, their competitors might try to ICO because they need money in order to start competing. You're right. It's hard for you to compete with an established company that's making a lot of revenue unless you have a mechanism to print your own money and get a bunch of unqualified investors to fund it.
Hmm, right. But then you said it before, right? You said there can only be one blockchain, which is a Bitcoin blockchain. So anyone betting on inventing their own blockchain or building on another blockchain is basically betting on the wrong horse.
I believe so, because the beauty of the Bitcoin blockchain is that it's an example of decentralization that is working. Prior to Bitcoin, the best example of decentralization we had was BitTorrent and file sharing. And I believe recently, companies like Netflix have started outpacing BitTorrent. I mean, eventually, it looks like it's becoming easier and easier to stream your music, to stream your movies, and paying small fees for it, that BitTorrent and pirating that media, it becomes a little more of a hassle and problematic. I always said that one of the reasons I used to like to download songs back in the early 2000s is because it was just easier for me. Mm-hmm. It was just easier for me to just download that song and I have that song forever. Those days are slowly going away. And people have to realize the purpose of decentralization is that you don't have a central point of failure. Mm-hmm. And if you're a centralized company trying to build a decentralized product, you are the point of failure and you always will be. So like so many of these concepts just make absolutely no sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, if we follow that logic, then every single one ICO is actually a scam and will fail.
Pretty much. In my opinion, it is. Now, a lot of the people creating these ICOs will absolutely disagree. And it does depend on the mechanism of the ICO. There is a handful of examples that are using the ICO concept and they are registering as securities. Mm-hmm. And they're just trying to utilize the latest technology, but they are saying that they are a security and they're trying to stay away from certain jurisdictions. But if you have to print your own money in order and then make up excuses why you have to print your own money in order to create your company, I don't see how your company is going to succeed.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Tone, you're also a blockchain consultant. And what do you do in that function?
Well, I just try to explain to people what a blockchain actually is. Again, I haven't really done much consulting lately. I just focus on my YouTube channel and I try to provide as much information for free as I can. Mm-hmm. But a few companies have brought me in to try and explain this to them, not from the a developer perspective, because I haven't looked at code in a really long time other than very basic stuff, but from a conceptual perspective, like what did Satoshi Nakamoto actually invent that was so innovative? And the answer is proof of work. This mechanism of validating transactions by burning electricity and solving this Byzantine generals problem that has plagued the digital world until 2009. And the problem was, how do you send a digital message where you lose possession of that message? That's always been a problem on the internet. Most people never even thought it was a problem. And mm-hmm. those that did, they could not figure out what can a solution be, because every time you send any digital data, whether it's a Word document, a song, a picture, a text message, anytime you send any digital data, you're always retaining a copy. There's always somebody in the middle that can see that and get that copy. And Bitcoin solved this problem where the Bitcoins that you send were actually leaving one computer and arriving at another computer without a middleman and without the person being able to retain a copy of that. And this is why for the first year of Bitcoin's existence, it actually wasn't worth any money. It was a very interesting experiment. Oh my God, is this problem actually solved? And once people realized, whoa, this problem might be solved, the message itself became used as money because it was now scarce and it wasn't able to be counterfeit. And you can't double spend it. You can't send the same message to two different people. One of them will disappear and the other person will hold on to it. So the message itself became money. And now it doesn't have to be money. It can be any kind of data, but it doesn't apply to many things because almost every message that you send, you don't want that message to be finite. You don't want this immutable property. Mm-hmm. Like here's an example. Lots of people are talking about real estate on the blockchain. To me, that makes absolutely no sense. Why do you want a property where you can accidentally delete the ownership of your real estate and there is nothing you can do about getting it back? You can accidentally send it to your neighbor and now your neighbor owns your property. Or people say, well, you create transparency and then government won't be able to take away your property. Mm. And I would say, oh, really? So what if the government puts it in the blockchain that they own this property? It's now theirs, right? Like it doesn't solve that problem. So putting things like real estate or medical records on the blockchain, mm-hmm. I don't understand how they make sense because they're not utilizing this property of unconfiscatable digital assets, which is another one of my favorite properties of Bitcoin. For the first time in human existence, you can own something of value that is impossible to confiscate if you took the proper measures of securing it and kept your mouth shut and didn't tell anyone, right? I mean, even if you hide the gold in your basement, there's always metal detectors that can find it. But not with Bitcoin, because you can store that in your head and it remains valuable.
Yeah. It's quite fascinating. I mean, is this what drew you originally to the idea?
Well, yes, but maybe a little bit too late. I first heard of Bitcoin in early 2011 when WikiLeaks was going to shut down, except they found a way to fund themselves by having this censorship-resistant value transfer in the form of donations when Visa, MasterCard, and PayPal cut them off and they had no way of paying their electric bills until Bitcoin actually saved them. That's when Bitcoin first came on my radar, but it wasn't until the incidents of Cyprus in early 2013 that really made me think when the Cyprus government just shut down the banks on Sunday and on Monday no one can get their money out. By the time they decided how much money they're going to confiscate from the people, they ended up taking 50% of everyone's bank accounts above 100,000 euros. So if you had 200,000 euros in the Bank of Cyprus, you lost 50,000 euros. And when that happened, I seriously started taking a look at Bitcoin because you can't confiscate Bitcoin if you're properly secured. And that's what got me down that rabbit hole. And I've been a big fan ever since. And another interesting thing, I have to credit one of my friends, Vortex, for saying this on Twitter once. A lot of us got into Bitcoin in those early days, 2013, some even earlier, even though some altcoins were already coming into existence. But he said a great one when he said, I got into Bitcoin because I hated the idea of the government just printing money and doing whatever they want. And now all I see around me is everyone wanting to print their own money in the form of these ICOs and altcoins and everything else.
I mean, would you say that all the altcoins basically took a great idea and then just bastardized it?
That's my view on it. So it's really hard for me. It's really hard for me to respect a lot of these initiatives that rely on printing their own money via ICO. Now, I understand that your idea needs funding, and I understand that you don't want to give up, 20, 30% of your company for a measly $100,000 from a VC. You'd rather go ICO if you can get 20, 30, 100 million in the door and given up nothing of your company. You, of course, are going to do that. Is that a good thing? I don't know, because when this gets out of control and so many people get scammed, you may ruin the concept of anyone giving anybody money ever again. Like, it really depends how big this bubble grows. But from the looks of it, we're going to be the tulips of the current millennium.
Yeah, some, not Bitcoin, I hope.
Yeah, I hope so as well.
When Cyprus happened, you were still at JP Morgan already?
I had already moved on to another company from JP Morgan. I was at JP Morgan from the collapse of Bear Stearns in 2008. And I think I left Bear Stearns in 2010 or so, maybe 11, when the unit that I was working for was sold to another company. Our entire risk division actually went on to another company. And then from there, a lot of us didn't like this merger, didn't like the acquisition. So a bunch of us quit and then went on to and then split between two other companies to try and, build a competing product. But yeah, I was still working, downtown a few blocks away from Wall Street at the time.
And then you saw what Bitcoin did or could do in Cyprus. And how did you decide to quit working in the traditional financial sector?
That took another couple of years. I started buying some Bitcoin in 2013, and I really kept reading every single article, couldn't shut up about it. Most people, you know, got fed up of listening to me about it. And I remember that the two bubbles of 2013. So the first time I bought my Bitcoin, I watched it go up to $250 on that Cypress news, and then I watched it crash down to $50. And then all of a sudden I'm sitting on a big losing position. I had to hang in there for a while, and then the bubble of late 2013 came, where the Bitcoin got to be over $1,000. And then the 2014 bear market, you know, wasn't fun at all. I lived throughout most of it. I still believed in Bitcoin. As it was falling all the way down, I believed that, you know, it's going to turn any day, it's going to turn any day. And at the same time, I'm writing articles for Cointelegraph, where I'm a technical analyst, and I continue to say, well, you know, as much as I believe in Bitcoin, the technical picture is calling for lower and lower prices. And when we bottomed out and got stuck at the lows of 2015, I really wanted to do something with some of my Bitcoin. So I started, you know, investing in some of the Bitcoin companies that I thought were good. And that ended very, very poorly because, again, I don't have expertise in investing. So a lot of that Bitcoin disappeared. So I lost a lot trying to play the VC game that I didn't have any experience in. And when the market started rebounding in 2015, I was already so into this crypto space, traveling and speaking at as many conferences as I could, continuing to write, starting to be a guest on people's podcasts. And I just didn't like my job. And I was bored and I wanted to do this. Mm-hmm. I wanted to quit and be a trader, basically, not only trading crypto, but also trading traditional markets, which is something I always wanted to do because my 10 years of Wall Street revolved around risk analysis and not actual trading. And trading has always been one of my passions. And I decided to quit my job in order to be a trader and on the side for fun. You know, speak at conferences, attend these crypto events, and, you know, be a guest on podcasts. It didn't really work out that way. I mean, my trading was doing okay, but I was really enjoying being a content creator and traveling the world and speaking at conferences. And that has now become almost my job. To where, once again, I don't have that much time for trading because I travel a good 9 months out of the year. I speak at as many conferences as anyone in the world, I would say, especially in the crypto space. Mm-hmm. I speak at so many of them, and there was plenty of demand on the internet that kept asking me to start my own YouTube channel, which I eventually did, and doing videos once a week, then twice a week, to now where there is sufficient demand for me to do daily videos. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that alone is very time consuming. And while I get a lot of criticism for talking about trading while not actually trading, that's the life I've chosen, to be a content creator over a trader. And if being a content creator starts to get frustrating and all this travel starts to wear me down, My backup plan is like it was 4 years ago now when I quit, is to, you know what, I'm going to take a break. I'm going to go offline and I'm just going to open my little hedge fund or a single family office with a couple of friends that I know are good traders and just trade our own money, consider outside external money. But I'd rather trade my own money. I never wanted to trade other people's money. And that's kind of my view on things. When I opened my physical business as I was quitting my job 3 or 4 years ago, I also did it with my own money. I didn't go for external money. I used my money to open a business. Yeah. It was a partnership. The business, you know, it still exists. It never made me a single dollar. It was probably a mistake. I should have put that money into Bitcoin or even just left it in a bank or put it in the S&P 500. But I did it with my own money. And I think that's the right way to do it. Mm-hmm. You have something, you try to do it yourself.
I couldn't agree more. It's absolutely true. I mean, all the companies and startups I ever you know, started and dreamt up. I always did them with my own money, except once, and that promptly failed. So, you know, it's not a good thing to be given a lot of money. And if you know how to bootstrap, I think that's much more powerful for an entrepreneur than having a lot of money at your disposal without even knowing what to do with it. And so I absolutely see the ICO point. Many people know you for the content, right, that you just described, and mainly the price targets of Bitcoin. How do you go about making these predictions?
I mean, I have lots of experience with technical analysis. After grad school, I studied financial engineering in grad school. And after grad school, as I was looking for my first job, it took a little while. It took me about a year to find my job because I had no actual experience, never been an intern in finance, didn't do it in undergrad. I didn't have any connections. Mm-hmm. So when I finished grad school in Florida and came back to New York, while I was looking for that first job, which turned out to be Bear Stearns in February of 2007, just as the market was coming to an end then. Mm-hmm. And while in the year leading up to looking for finding that job, I was a college adjunct professor, and me and one of my friends took a course on trading and technical analysis, and I absolutely fell in love with it. This is pretty much the same course that I now teach as my workshop as I traveled the world. I think I did maybe about 6 or 7 of them this year already, and I'm going to try to do another 6 or 7, try to do them in as many different places as possible. And the course that I took was like 2 days of learning how to read charts and candlesticks and moving averages and all of these other technical tools. Cool. And me having some finance background, a math background, loving patterns, loving solving puzzles. Like, I absolutely fell in love with trading, and I wanted to do it ever since. And while I, once again, delaying my life of being a professional trader, I have enough experience of both ups and downs with trading, because I've always tried to do it on the side, even mm-hmm. while I had all these jobs, even though in some of those jobs I had a lot more restrictions on what I could and couldn't trade. That experience, plus my educational background of being a high school teacher out of undergrad, then a college adjunct, not afraid to speak in public, having a great ability to explain things. I've been a tutor throughout most of my college career. Also, while I was in grad school, I was a TA teaching my own classes. Like, my ability to explain things and my 10 to 15 years now of looking at charts and reading charts and experience in trading, I think make me a really good educator on helping up-and-coming traders understand what they're doing better. Mm-hmm. And while there's absolutely no guarantee that learning technical analysis is going to make you money, if you don't know technical analysis and you're going to be an active trader, it's almost like, you know, going out on a racetrack with professional, you know, car drivers with barely having the ability to drive. You're going to get yourself in a lot of trouble. It doesn't mean you're going to win, but if you know how to drive a race car, but you have a lot more experience. Another analogy I like to use is poker. You do not know what the next card is going to come out of the deck, but you put yourself in proper situations by being patient and knowing probability and statistics, so that when you do put money on a hand, you have a statistical advantage of winning that hand, and you're not just doing it randomly. So, and I think technical analysis helps provide these tools for traders.
How is Bitcoin different from other assets in terms of technical analysis?
It's really not that different. And this is one of the things that currently has me in lots of, you know, useless Twitter debates, where the bear market of 2014 played out exactly like the gold bear market that we've had since 2011, and we may or may not be out of that gold bear market. The way prices fell in gold from 1900 down to just over 1,000 took a very similar path to what Bitcoin did in 2014. Granted, Bitcoin did it in faster amount of time, but the path was about the same. And I'm watching the same thing play out once again here in 2018. And while nobody knows if it's going to end in a similar way to 2014, because in 2014 we fell a good 90%, so far our the $6,000 low was about 70 and change percent. So will we fall another 20% from the top, which probably means about 50% more from the current $6,000 low? My chart's telling me that we will. I'm optimistic. I'm hoping that we won't. I did go. So another YouTuber did bait me into a $10,000 bet whether the price of Bitcoin would fall below 6,000 or not. I said that we will fall below 6,000. So I have some money riding on this. I try not to bet on these things. I try not to have any positions that have me profiting from the price of Bitcoin. In fact, if Bitcoin falls, the only thing I gain is that $10,000 bet, but I'm holding on to my Bitcoin. So, and the consulting charge and my workshops are priced in Bitcoin at 0.1 Bitcoin. So if Bitcoin falls to $2,000, now I'm only charging $200 versus the $2,000 my services cost. So I gain absolutely nothing from the price of Bitcoin falling. And that bet on the $6,000 is a bet I would love to lose. I would rather pay $10,000 knowing that I have a lot of money, you know, stashed away because the price of Bitcoin went through the roof and broke the $20,000 high. But I'm trying to be honest with my followers, and I have a pretty dedicated group of people that watch my videos. And if I start talking about how Bitcoin's going to go higher, 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 I would be lying not only to them, but also to myself. So I look at the charts. I try to be unbiased as possible. I use all of my trading experience from before Bitcoin ever existed. And I think that's important, because so many people have become traders in crypto space without having ever traded any other assets before Bitcoin. And these people think that they're experts, and they think that they're smarter than anyone that came before them. And that's just completely not true.
Being at the right place at the right time.
Yeah. And like some of the books that were written in the 1930s after the 1929 bubble could still be some of the most useful books on trading you could ever read. And that's almost 100 years now, right? Because this stuff doesn't change.
Yeah. What's a good book there? Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, or which one do you like?
Yeah, that's a good one. There's a couple of others. I'm already, the names of those books are not in my head. I mean, the books by Andreas Antonopoulos and Saifedean, The Bitcoin Standard, is a book I would recommend in the crypto space. If you are going to pick up a book in the traditional finance and trading space, I do recommend The Art of Execution by Lee Freeman. That's probably a book you want to read and then look around. I did study a lot of this trading stuff, but not books. I just I prefer videos, and I prefer learning from people. And while it amazes me how the things that I teach in my workshop, I have all of it written out on my website with links and for people to study. And I tell people there is nothing in my workshop that you can't learn on your own for free. And people still show up. And it's hard for me to understand, but I was also that person. Like, it's hard for me to like concentrate and be motivated on my own. I'd rather show up into this one-day boot camp and learn it and get the basics and then follow up with individual individual concepts that I may not understand.
Yeah, good point. So I want to go back again to something you said. You said it's very similar to gold, but it's maybe faster. So the time scale seems maybe a little bit compressed. I mean, is this maybe the only difference between Bitcoin or maybe other crypto assets and more traditional stock markets?
It could be a difference. I believe that because information travels faster, every single decade around the world, that these panics will also happen a lot faster because of the traveling of the information. But the way that information gets processed by a human is still about the same. Now, we can also say that computers can process that information faster, which is true. But at the end of the day, all speculative markets are driven by fear and greed. And it's still humans at the end of the buy and sell trigger. And this bear market in Bitcoin will bottom when, the last big player has sold and given up. And it will once again top when the last big player has bought and there's nobody left to buy. That's how all of these markets top, and that's how they all go down. So at the end of the day, it's still driven by human emotions. And this is why, while the time scale of Bitcoin's ups and downs might change a little bit, overall, it's still driven by speculators. Now, one of the things we could potentially compare Bitcoin to is something like oil, which was probably worthless, prior to what, 1880, 1890? And then all of a sudden it became very valuable. And so there is this mass adoption stage where the price just goes up, 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 up. And then it once again becomes volatile based on speculation, but it doesn't even go anywhere near the lows because of this mass adoption or a discovery that this natural resource went from being the worst thing to find under your shovel to being the best thing to find under your shovel. So if Bitcoin does reach that one paradigm, we could go straight up high enough. And then all of a sudden, everyone is using it, and it will once again be volatile, but it will no longer come back down. But because of the current move, I think that there are still low-end targets, and most of Bitcoin price is still complete speculation on its future use than its current use. And until its actual use starts to go up, actually, I would have loved to have been in those oil days. Was there a similar environment where the future expectation use of oil, let's say in 1895, would drive it up and then down big until all of a sudden the car comes out or World War One happens, where there's this massive demand for oil where the price goes up and stays up, even though it's still volatile, but it doesn't even come close to going back to prior highs.
It's an interesting analogy because, the narrative is I guess, different, but it's similarly loaded, right? I mean, all of a sudden you had the Saudis dig up the oil in the desert, and then the markets in the US crashed, right? So now you have maybe Bitcoin, and then somebody comes up with a new version of Bitcoin, and there goes the price of Bitcoin.
Well, that's the thing, right? It's hard. If someone comes up with a better version of Bitcoin to where the price of Bitcoin goes bye-bye, why would anyone trust a better version of Bitcoin if all of a sudden these blockchains are now, not very fungible and people can just switch to another one? So many people, myself included, have enough value saved in Bitcoin that if Bitcoin goes away, I will never trust any other blockchain the rest of my life with store of value. Sure, I'll use it as a medium of exchange, but I would rather store my my savings in dollars. At least I know I'm only losing 2% a year instead of the ability to it going to zero, tomorrow. Or I would store it in the S&P 500. It's that store of value property that will disappear from all blockchains if Bitcoin goes away. And this is another reason why I don't think it's going to happen. Maybe someone will come up with a better medium of exchange, though I doubt it, because some of the smartest computer engineers are working on Bitcoin and getting it to scale. Everyone makes fun of Bitcoin, how it's slow and it could be expensive, even though not anymore, and why Bitcoin has difficulty scaling. Meanwhile, no one is actually using their alternative. If their alternative even had 20% of the amount of stress the Bitcoin system currently has, it'll probably grind to a halt and already be destroyed.
Interesting. Where do you think do all these other crypto assets next to Bitcoin, where do you think do they fall short?
I think a lot of those other crypto assets, I mean, they mostly fall short is because they will never be as distributed as Bitcoin around the world. The beauty of Bitcoin is that it spread around the world while it was worthless. And people have always been skeptical of Bitcoin because they're always thinking it's too expensive and it's not going to work. And it continues to just work. The Bitcoin system never goes down. And most of these other projects, they rely on a leader. And most of the time, that leader creates that centralization. And if when people say that, oh, 0.2% of Bitcoin addresses hold like 40% of all of Bitcoins, but it's a lot worse in any other alternative to Bitcoin. It's still the most trusted, the most secure. It's very difficult to 51% attack Bitcoin by taking over 50% of the mining network. And we've already seen that with several alternatives that were claiming to be better just in this month alone. I mean, they have lots of problems. And the biggest problem they have is, Satoshi solved this one problem, and that was absolutely amazing. Satoshi is not with us, and I'm pretty certain. I mean, my experience on Wall Street was always working with developers and even interviewing developers. And even though I wasn't actually a developer, I had to surround myself with some of the best developers. So I have lots of experience with that. And I guarantee you that several of the people that are currently coding on the Bitcoin protocol are significantly better coders than Satoshi was because there's always someone better. It's just that they were not able to get that missing piece of proof of work and creating that mining system. But at this point, some of the smartest and most respected computer engineers are coding on Bitcoin, and there is hundreds of them, and the best an alternative can put up is maybe one or two. It's just not there. And people like Satoshi that create this kind of innovation, they don't come around every 3 months. I mean, it's a once in a generation breakthrough whose time had finally come.
Let's take a quick break for a message from our sponsors. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own, the Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes, so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. I want to ask one thing more about the information, right? If somebody's interested in this space or maybe doesn't know that much yet about Bitcoin, or even if they do, if they want to go deeper and learn more, where do you think should they go?
Oh, wow. There's so much misinformation out there on the internet. You can't even go to Bitcoin.com anymore because they have, you know, forked into Bcash. So it's really, really difficult. I mean, I believe that my YouTube channel is one of the best. And we do a morning show where we cover the latest news in the crypto space. I don't do it by myself. I try to surround myself by people that are smarter than me. My co-host, Leah Wald, you know, she has several degrees in economics. You know, she's worked all over the world, started some companies, worked for the World Bank. And Jimmy Song is a core developer who understands programming really, really well. And Giacomo Zucco, who runs BHV Network out of Italy, where they provide a co-working space and they host some core developers. And I try to surround myself by people that can, that, you know, smarter than I am to help me understand and explain this space to people. Another great resource I would recommend is Andreas Antonopoulos and his YouTube channel, and try to catch all of his content. And Trace Mayer and the Bitcoin Knowledge Podcast is also good. Same thing. Like I know I'm naming more podcasts because I'm more of an audio video person than reading books, as I've mentioned. So these are some very good resources. Another podcast is called Noted Podcast by Michael Goldstein and Pierre Richard. Another great podcast that will educate you on Bitcoin. But other than that, it's really hard to recommend good resources, because I would say 90% of all the people I respected when I, before, as I was buying my very first Bitcoin in 2013, I have no respect for 90% of those people anymore, because they've gone the ICO route, they've gone the altcoin route, they've tried to, you know, coerce Bitcoin with SegWit 2x, and try to hard fork to a bigger blocks, which went against, you know, some of the, it wasn't going to work. So I've lost respect for 90% of the people that I kind of trusted as I went into the space, which is why I'm very, very hesitant in any recommendations these days.
What makes, how could someone tell if an information resource has good information?
Just always try to listen to a counter argument, I guess. And I guess always be skeptical. You're dealing with the wild, wild west of a new technology. And it's funny, when I left Wall Street and I was into that whole libertarian and like the anarchist kind of ideas. And when I left Wall Street, I had it in my head that maybe even myself included, we're all like, you know, scammers, and Wall Street doesn't really do anything, just moving money around, you know, causing these bubbles. And now I'm in the crypto space and I'm like, wow, I was surrounded back then. I was surrounded by some of the smartest, most honest people I still know today, compared to what I'm surrounded by here in the crypto space. And it's very, very frustrating. So I say, just question everything, be skeptical. And when someone is pitching you an ICO or an investment idea, just picture yourself walking through like the streets of New York or LA or a third world country, and someone off the street comes up to you trying to sell you this idea. That's pretty much how you have to look at it. And
it's quite a learning curve still, though, I think, for many people, and it can be very, very daunting how to get into it right at the beginning.
Yes,
I think it's very hard to find good information out there, but it's also hard to decide what is actually good information.
Absolutely.
What kind of time frame do you think people should look at when they're interested in Bitcoin?
I think they have to look at it from an investor time frame. I mean, the internet didn't develop in a year, right? I mean, I remember hearing about the internet, I would say as early as 1995. I was still in high school. When I got to college, my first semester in my university, we had to use Unix commands to access university email. And then in my second semester, we got webmail, and we were all so happy because it was so much easier with an interface. And look how long it took for the internet to be functional, to the point of where, you know, we're having Skype calls. Even though Skype came early, I mean, the technology wasn't great. It took a while. You know, it took a good 10 years. I would say, unless you are planning to be a trader, unless you're planning to study as a trader, unless you're going to make trading your job, you should have at least a 3 to 4 year outlook if you're going to purchase and hold on to some Bitcoin. At least hold them through a halving period, because every 3.5 to 4 years, the Bitcoin, the production of new Bitcoin cuts in half, and that constrains the Bitcoin new Bitcoins coming into existence, creating that element of deflation, which does add value onto your Bitcoins. Now, I would say that's not the most important property that gives Bitcoin value. The most important property, of course, is the usability of Bitcoin, and it's as long as it remains with its core properties of being censorship resistant and unconfiscatable and decentralized. Now, as long as those properties remain, and keep an eye on the, you know, on the advancements. So as these advancements continue to happen and Bitcoin remains without any downtime whatsoever, it's, you know, more and more people would learn to trust it. Just like in the late 90s, how many people were quitting their jobs and other than the dot-com bubble side of things, right? In the early to mid 90s, how many people believed that the internet would work the next day like it did the prior day? Kind of like you wake up in the morning, you expect the sun to rise. I wake up in the morning, I expect my internet to work. When my internet doesn't work in the morning, it's either my router or my internet service provider. The internet itself doesn't go down. And that's because of the great engineering that was done behind it. Bitcoin needs to bring the same confidence to people. And when people are confident that the value that they store in Bitcoin will not go down the following day because of underlying technological issues, that's when the value of Bitcoin should significantly rise, I believe.
It should significantly rise, but what would be something that could bring it down to zero?
Oh, wow. The worst case scenarios for Bitcoin would be some kind of a technological attack. The mining structure failing, a bug that cannot be resolved, and the breakdown of the encryption that keeps your Bitcoin secure. Like if someone was to design some kind of a program that is able to be so fast that you can crack other people's passwords. Like right now, when you create a very secure password, in the case of Bitcoin, most of them is a combination of random 12 words. Or you can create your own password. But if somebody can write some kind of an algorithm that can start breaking these encryptions by breaking the passwords, that could be a major confidence loss. So every currency, it's a loss of confidence. The US dollar is no different. A loss of confidence in the US dollar will, you know, make it go the way of the Venezuelan Bolivar, because there's a loss of confidence in the Venezuelan government. So your currency goes into hyperinflation because of that. So a loss of technological confidence in Bitcoin due to, you know, some kind of major malfunctions. Again, no different than the internet, right? There could be a major malfunction where our internet would just suddenly stop working. And that would also affect Bitcoin, though there are Bitcoin engineers that are trying to, you know, we already have some satellites in space that would allow you to make Bitcoin transactions without the internet. And that's another backup plan, you know, because one day it's possible that Bitcoin is more important than the internet. So you need a way for Bitcoin to function without an expectation of global internet running well. You will always need some internet somewhere in order to process the transactions. But the ability to use Bitcoin as money in regions with very poor internet usage is also important that people are working on. I will say that if the government wanted to, you know, cause major harm to Bitcoin, all they have to do is eliminate money laundering laws and not confiscate other people's money. And I think that would be very difficult for Bitcoin, because now instead of also competing on terrible government laws, Bitcoin would only get to compete on inflation versus deflation debate. Is a deflationary currency better than an inflationary currency? That has been an economic debate for probably for centuries. And Right now, Bitcoin has a huge advantage because it doesn't only compete on that debate. It also competes on the fact that governments are trying to make cash more and more illegal, and they continue to double down on money laundering laws that Bitcoin just couldn't care less about.
That's a good point. Yeah, with the money laundering, do you think we're past that point where a failure is possible?
We're not. Everything is just technology, and Bitcoin is still pretty young. We are certainly not past that point. And this is why lots of people remain skeptical on, the future of Bitcoin. There is still, there are still outside chances. We still have only a couple of manufacturers of ASIC chips that are mining these Bitcoins. Governments still control, electricity, and there could be issues there. And most of your on-ramps are still centralized. But as far as the underlying technology, as long as the smartest people, smartest developers in the world continue to develop on Bitcoin and make it better, I think that there is significantly more upside than downside.
What do you think are most people misunderstanding still about Bitcoin?
It's not a misunderstanding. I don't think most people still comprehend the importance of, censorship-resistant value transfer and the fact that you can own something that is unconfiscatable, even if it's simply in digital form. And something unconfiscatable has to be in digital form, because if it's in physical form, someone with a bigger gun will always be able to take it from you. So I think it's just these concepts. And unless people have experienced or something like that, that they need these properties, it's going to be hard for them to really comprehend until there is some kind of an economic incident in their region.
Mm-hmm. But now, there's many people who are very much pointing on those properties, right, and say this is very important without having experienced the necessity for them, right? What is it maybe that makes somebody a believer in those properties and somebody else is still on the fence?
Well, right. Those properties have to be important to you. Now, even though I personally haven't really experienced it, but I have studied and read about economics and finance long enough to understand how important these properties are. So for those that haven't experienced these because of their regional locations, you do have to, immerse yourself in the understanding of finance and markets and the history of crashes, mm-hmm. and the history of what happens. How extreme do governments get when they're facing, an overthrow? That's how these things usually happen. It was no different than Rome or any other economic collapse of a country.
Yeah. Do you think in the Western world, do you think we're moving towards such a point, or do you think that's more just speculation?
I think it's a little more speculation. I think a lot of people have been predicting the death of the U.S. dollar for, as long as I remember. And it's going to happen eventually. Look, the U.S. being a world superpower and the U.S. dollar being the world reserve currency is starting to push historical limits of, that 100-year cycle of how long a currency stays in power. But there is really nobody stepping up on the horizon. When the U.S. took over from the British pound back at the turn of the 20th century, mm-hmm. You saw the U.S. rising. China was starting to rise over the last couple of decades, but it looks like they're not ready to take over yet. So it's possible, but your currency is as good as the confidence in your political system. And right now, the world still trusts, the politics of the U.S. more than any other, major region or country.
Tone, did you always want to be an educator?
That's a good question. I mean, not when I was a little kid, but even as I was starting out in my, 17, 18 years old, I did want to be a teacher, mm-hmm. but being a high school teacher for 1 year taught me that I don't really like teaching people that don't want to listen to me. Mm-hmm. And, high school teachers have to do that. They have to, get people to listen to them when they don't want to. And this is why I do what I do now, and I absolutely love it, because I don't force anyone to listen to me. And I tell people, if you don't like what I have to say, then just don't listen. Don't listen to my YouTube channel. I always find it funny how people, most of my YouTube videos are at least an hour long, and I sometimes get very critical comments about something that happened towards the end of my podcast. And my answer is, well, you hate what I have to say, but yet you sat through the whole thing.
Good point.
And I really, I do enjoy it. We'll see how long I enjoy it, because I've gone through many changes in my interests. I tend to get bored. I actually started out as a geology major and looking to be a geologist. When I was a teacher, I was a science teacher. Hmm. So I went from geology to high school teaching to financial engineering to a little bit of a college professor working on Wall Street, trader for a little bit. Now I'm a content creator in the finance space. I do have other interests. I was always an athlete. I always wanted to do like a diet and exercise YouTube channel as well. So we'll see. We'll see what the future holds. But the moment I get bored, there's going to be a change. If I have time for like one very quick story, when I got that Bear Stearns job, I was taking over a guy that was with that unit from the very beginning. He was there like 8 years, mm-hmm. and he was just quitting without a big plan on what he's going to do next. And I was so happy to take over his job, but I couldn't help but ask him, why are you leaving? He was probably making hundreds of thousands of dollars with such a senior position. And he said to me, when your walk or commute to work becomes more enjoyable than the work, it's time to move on. And I never understood it until it was time for me to quit.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Excellent. Who are your role models?
Oh, wow. I don't usually get these questions. I honestly don't know. I mean, everyone always says your family, and that's an easy answer. So of course my parents, who, immigrated from communist Russia when I was a kid. So mm-hmm. I grew up, my early years were spent there. So picking up and leaving and coming to a new country without knowing the language. That's the obvious answer. Outside of that, in the current space, my role models are people that just innovated on their own, mm-hmm. people that just did it. And like, which is why I don't see anyone coming out of this ICO space. It's Satoshi Nakamoto. It is someone that, comes up with a new economic theory. It is like a doctor that, has a breakthrough in some new medicine that usually happens by just, a doctor that was just researching it on his own, not some lab that spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to get this, cure. So it's people like that, that, were smart enough to just go and do it or start that company with no funding and just their will and getting it done. It's people like that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that story before, right? From the guy who quit his job because he was just so bored. But is there a similar thing where you did the same?
I don't think so. I don't think I'm smart enough to do something that innovative. But I will say that after I learned how to trade, I learned the class that I currently teach, which is the basics of technical analysis. Mm-hmm. And then I took a more advanced class on options, and I absolutely fell in love with options. And my college roommate, actually, who I took that course with, me and him then spent almost a year perfecting one specific option strategy. And we got it to a point where this should be the only strategy that we trade. And I want to trade it, but it's almost like, I don't want to say it's too easy of making money, but money doesn't really motivate me. But the stuff that we've done with perfecting trades with options, we really could write a book and even name new option strategy that doesn't even exist right now in the financial space. So I guess that's as close as I came of perfecting a trading strategy that has insanely low risk of losing money on a given trade with pretty good reward potential. And these trades don't come around every day. They only come around a few times a year. But being that meticulous and coming up with something that will beat the market year after year after year, probably indefinitely until we no longer are keeping our mouth shut and decide to publish it and let the world know. So that's probably as close as I came, but the only way it's useful is if for no one to know it exists, which I've probably already said too much.
Is there anything else that you would do differently when you look back?
Not much, because I don't like to, you know, I mean, hindsight is always 20/20. There's not much I would do differently because I'm pretty happy with where I am today. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't for all of the mistakes of the past, I wouldn't be here today. People always say, oh, I wish I bought Bitcoin in 2011. And that doesn't mean you'd be in better position today. Mm-hmm. You know, you buying Bitcoin in 2011, you could have lost all of that Bitcoin in the Mt. Gox disaster and hated the environment so much and never would have gotten back in. So it's really hard to say. So even all of the mistakes that I've made with trying to open businesses and investing in businesses, as much as I wish I wouldn't do it, because I am happy with the current hour and time and where I am right now, I don't really regret all that much.
Cool. I mean, imagine Satoshi had never written that white paper and there was no Bitcoin and no blockchain. What do you think would you be doing?
I probably would be a trader right now because I always wanted to quit my job and become a trader. I would absolutely be a trader. Would I be globally known as a content creator? Would I still be? Because the workshop that I teach is not trading Bitcoin. It's trading any asset. Would I have built my social media profile? Would I be this YouTuber right now without Bitcoin? Probably not. Or I would be so much further along because it was a lot easier for me to break through as a content creator in the small crypto space versus trying to do it in a traditional space where guys like me are on YouTube are a dime a dozen trying to, you know, do trading videos. But I would probably be at home. Full-time trader or running a little family office or maybe even a hedge fund if I chose to take outside money.
Mm-hmm. What would you trade?
Well, I've traded pretty much everything except currencies. So I definitely would not be trading currencies. I was day trading futures for a little while, like oil, S&P, gold. Also options. I'd probably be focusing on options trading during earnings season, which has been some of my most successful type of trading. Mm-hmm. I would probably focus on that. It also gives you a decent amount of free time because you trade for a month and you take a 2-month break.
Do you have a wish for the cryptocurrency space for the future?
Oh, wow. No, I think it's as frustrating as the crypto space is, it has to play out the way it is. I mean, the bubbles of the dot-com and the 08 crisis, they have to play out in this way so people understand and learn. A lot of people blame the banks for the 08 financial crisis, but no one forced you to pay, you know, $1 million for a house. because the price kept going up and up and up. And a lot of these banks just got into groupthink because their competition started giving out these very loose mortgages without and their investor competition started purchasing these, you know, credit default swaps and all of these other financial instruments that were giving them outsized returns for a little while until it all crashed. And as a competitor in those industries, you almost have to also buy into this or you go out of business even earlier. And that's kind of what I'm seeing now from the ICO space. If you struggle to raise $100,000 from a VC, giving up a say in your company and 20% equity, and your competitor who you feel is inferior with their technology, but they are competing with you, just raised $100 million with an ICO, you almost have no choice but to also ICO because they are going to outcompete you in the advertising world and they're going to steal all of your business even if your technology is better. So I can totally see the entire world getting into this groupthink that everyone should be printing their own money. And I hope it doesn't get too bad, but this is just how things have to play out. If I did have a wish of something, I wish more people were honest, which is a problem in this space. And my honesty gets criticized in that when I say I think Bitcoin is going down in price, but I'm not actually profiting from its downside, and people think that's absolutely silly. But I try to be as objective as possible. And a lot of my fellow YouTubers, you know, they talk up their trades, and this happens on TV and traditional markets as well. And even though in traditional markets there is some regulation to try and stop that, how can you really stop it, right? Someone going on TV in order to, you know, profit from the position they've already taken on. This is not that big a deal, but it's in my realm of what I do. So it's kind of important to me, and it bothers me when people all around me are doing this and then I get accused of doing it as well when I actually don't.
So in general, you think just ethics, people should step up in that department a little bit, or not just a little bit, a lot.
Yeah, I think ethics are lacking greatly in the crypto space. And it's something I no longer say about Wall Street because most of the people I met there, highly educated, even though I know a degree is not as important, but highly educated people, they have families. I mean, no one wanted to see Bear Stearns go out of business. Why would 100,000 people plus want to lose their jobs, right? Nobody wanted to see that. Nobody wants to see an economic crash. And people just end up getting into groupthink with bad investments. But most of the people that I met on Wall Street, I mean, they're pretty honest people. They're just, you know, sometimes you end up in a bubble, which is what I'm seeing from the crypto space. Hopefully, when it's over, it'll make the people in the crypto space a lot more humble and understand how it happened in the first place.
What do you see on the horizon for Bitcoin in the next few years?
I do see Bitcoin becoming more popular for this value transfer. I see Lightning Network actually going live for people to use within the next 1 or 2 years, and it'll help Bitcoin scale greatly. I mean, the big wild card is the governments and their financial systems. What happens with Italy? What happens with the euro? Will the euro, you know, still be around as a single currency? Those have always been my questions for 5 or 6 years now. Will the governments continue to double down on money laundering laws, which are very critical and why Bitcoin is so popular to begin with? I was always worried that the governments are going to try to make Bitcoin illegal and go after people, but that hasn't happened yet, so that's a good thing. As far as price is concerned, I do think that we are going to make a low sometime this year, probably September, October. We should bottom out in the price of Bitcoin, and then we're ready to go to the upside. So a couple of years from now, I am expecting new all-time highs, hopefully, you know, $50,000 per Bitcoin and higher. Do I think the altcoin and ICO space are going to hit a bubble and implode? I do. Do I think it will happen in the next 2 years? Probably. But it's also possible that it's going to extend some more. It's really impossible to predict when a bubble will actually pop. It's mostly just luck.
Cool. Tone, this was really fantastic. I mean, okay. I could go on and ask many more questions. It's really interesting. And I thank you very much for your insight.
Excellent.
And for taking time today.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today. More info on our guests and our sponsors is in the show notes of this episode and on the podcast website, theblockchainandus.com. To help people find this podcast, it's important that you download, subscribe, and give it a top rating and review on iTunes or on the podcast platform of your choice. I'm Manuel Staggers, and I thank you very much for listening.